بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم نحمده ونصلي على رسوله الكريم During the course of this year, while I was reading over certain issues, then a few points came to mind which I made a note of. And normally when a program has to come up, then I see what I'm reading at the moment and what I found that benefited me for a bit. So this is just called a mudhakara or a repetition of what mutala or what has come in front of me. This is no real bayan really, it's just taking us through a period of history. And the reason why I found this was so beneficial for myself was that many things that have happened in this last, what we will call 200, 300 years, because we grew up in the last 20 years, 30 years, and perhaps our parents, they saw it, but it never clicked, so they would never tell us how the world was. Because of that, we just thought that it has been like this. And in every era, whoever sees his era only, and he doesn't see before and after. After, you will see it in the light of the ahadith. Before it, you will see in the light of history. Whoever could never see it would always wonder, how come this happened? How come this happened? You see the world we are situated in today. We all understood Islam is the mightiest power in the world. But at the moment, we don't feel that might. We see Islam from every side is the one that is under. Islam is the one that is catching it. Islam is nowhere in the markets. Islam is nowhere in the government. So a small child who grows up and he understands the might of Islam, but he doesn't see it. Then he starts wondering, was this ever there? So as I was reading about history, three things really shone out to me, which according to me was like a very unique point of the world. What it is that Allah Tabarakatullah made a system, it's as though there are two rounds in the match of Islam against the world of kufr. I will mention first round one, and then we will come into round two. We are living in round two. Round one would be from the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam till about 950 years after Hijri. So the first 1,000 years will be round one. What is round two is not really known, but it is a point to wonder and to think about. And it is not being said with conviction, but it is said with a possibility. Imam Suyuti rahimullah, he explained that this ummah will only have 1,500 years. It will be more than 1,400, it will not be more than 1,500. For whatever reasons he said it and what he saw in the ahadith, it is something to think about. That if round one was 1,000 years, and in history it really seems round one was 1,000 years, and then one round two, if it's going to be 500 years, then you must understand that me and you both are sitting near the very end of round two. After round two, we don't really think there will be a round three. Then the match will be wrapped up. What was the unique thing and the salient feature of round one and round two? In both rounds, the enemies were the same. There were three enemies. And Islam had to stand up against three. In round one, it also seemed impossible. And in round two, it also seems impossible. In round one, Islam defeated all three, and in round two, he'll definitely defeat it. But unique, these three enemies. The first enemy, which we will all understand, is what is called the non-Muslim element. But it was always unique that so many non-Muslims in the world, but Allah Tabarakallah had decreed that one group of the non-Muslim, which is called the Christian element, or more than the Christian, the European, who will hold on to the Christian religion. That was the enemy. It could have been anybody else in the world. They were atheists. They were Buddhists. But it had to be this group. And the ahadith had mentioned that your war with the people of Rome, that will continue. It will go in different circles. And that's what happened. In round one, it was the European Christian. At that time, they were in the name of the church. And in today's time, it's the European Christian in the name of the United States, the name of Great Britain. That was the enemy number one. Enemy number two in round one was the inner enemy, what we would normally call a hypocrite, a group that looks like a Muslim, he dresses like a Muslim, he behaves like a Muslim, and from within he starts biting at the surface of Islam. He is more harder to handle than the outside enemy.
And there were many groups. Famous amongst those that study knowledge, they will understand there was a group called Mu'tazila. And a lot of detail. And then there will be this group, and it could go into 60, 70, 80 different groups. But the group that featured the biggest in round one and in round two was going to be called the Shia. This was Shaitan's baby from within, and the baby from without was going to be a European Christian. And then there was the third enemy. And this is the one that's the most unique of three. He was always known as the hidden enemy from both parties. Neither the Shia knew who he is, neither did the European Christian know who he is. But it was because of him that the Shia fought against the Muslim, and that the European Christian fought against the Muslim. He remained so hidden that hardly in history his name would come. But he would be the one handling the whole matter. He would be perhaps the only one who would understand why wars take place in the world. Why is World War I? Why is World War II? Why the war of Iraq, the war of Afghanistan? The other parties would just be fighting. So to understand that, we will go into the first part. We will go very fast through that history, what happened. You will see the three enemies, how they came up and in what a unique manner. Then we will come into round two, and you will see the repetition of the three enemies and how again they did the same thing. Round one, the area we will go into, because it's got to do with the land of Masjid al-Aqsa. So it starts about 300 after Hijri. 300 years after the death of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, approximately. And it will go on to about 300 to another 250 years, 550, 600. What will happen in this era? For some reason, the European Christian, what we call at that time the church, and all of us would have done it in school, it was called the Crusades. Some reason which none of the Christians could understand, because if you say 300 years or 450 years after Hijri, the call of the Crusades were made. So a normal person would ask the Christians that for the last 400 years you never thought of Jerusalem. During that time there was no problem. It was not the Holy Land. It was not a land in need of your services. Suddenly the call was made. Not a single Christian of the Crusades understood why he was going to the land of Aqsa, but they all landed up there. In today's time, if you ask any American why you landed in Afghanistan, he does not know. Why you landed in Iraq, he does not know. Why did you have World War I and World War II? They don't know. The war just took place. But the unique part of history was that whenever the Christian world had to fall on the Muslim Ummah, before that an effort had to be made that the Shia regime must be established. Which an alim wrote most beautifully, had it not been for the existence of the Shia, neither in round one would the European Christian have managed to do what he did, and neither in round two. How this happened? So first we will go into the history of the Shia. So very beautifully one alim wrote, very quickly I will go through this. He wrote, in the year 296 after Hijri, 300 years after Hijri, in the land of North Africa, Qayrawan, which was a center of Islam, a man by the name of Ubaidullah. Later on, history would prove that this Ubaidullah was nothing but Satanist in and out. We will say Satanist, they called him Jew. He would enter Qayrawan, and within a few days, he would announce, I am the promised Mahdi. I am the one that everyone wants. Normally, if a man comes to any town, he comes to Hilal, and he stands up and he says, I'm the Mahdi. Follow me, no one will follow. But these people, when they come, they don't just come one man, they come with an entire force. There's a whole shaitani movement to make it happen. So he enters into an Islamic land, full Islam. And within a few years, the entire North Africa is nothing but Shia. In such a manner he does it, the madhab of North Africa at that time was the madhab of Imam Malik rahimullah. Like how we have the madhab of Imam Abu Hanifa. A historian writes that after power was attained, the group exposed their reality. Now look at what they did. The sign of the Shia in group 1 and group 2, exactly the same. The first point of the Shia was to swear the Sahaba, especially the wives of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. 300 years after Hijri, group 2 will do the same. The second claim was that every Sahabi except a group of 5 or 10 became murtad on the death of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam in a land which was nothing but Islam. But for this to be said, you would wonder how could it go? But in group 1 it happened, and in group 2 it happened. The third, whoever was going to oppose this group was going to be severely tortured. A historian writes, the amount of scholars and righteous men who had died in the prison during the time of Ubaidullah were more than 4,000. He says, as for those that were killed in front of their houses, that number has never been recorded. The bodies of the ulama would be dragged in the streets, and soldiers would be screaming loudly that if anyone passes any fatwa on the madhab of Malik, then he will be the next one on the street. Just a amal on the madhab of Imam Malik was regarded as the worst crime of the time. So that was North Africa. But how it worked? From North Africa, so there was three conditions. One is the hatred of Sahaba. One is that all Sahaba became kafir. The third is, if you oppose us, you will be killed. The fourth was, Hayya ila khayril amal. And this seems like a very small thing, but it was a very big thing for the Shia in group 1 and group 2. That in the adhan, how we have Hayya ala salah, Hayya ala falah. This extra addition of Hayya ila khayril amal had to be added. It was the sign of that the land is for the Shia. Hayya ila khayril amal. And today in group 2, that is what the adhan is. Hayya ila khayril amal. And the fifth was that there will be no Taraweeh. The Taraweeh must be abolished. So 5 signs Ubaidullah came. The result was scholars were not allowed to teach. Haram became halal. The Ubaidullah, who was the Mahdi of the time, and today's present Iran is group 2. And we will explain it how exactly. He writes, when Ubaidullah would come up in the majma, he would come in the skin of an animal, and the skin would be upside down. Upside down skin means whatever was haram before, I, on the permission of Allah, have made it halal. It is called I'm an imam. That's the meaning of an imam. That what the Nabi said was not the final. I can now make one more thing final. So whatever was haram has now become halal. Then he would crawl in front of the people. And he said, because you obey me and listen to me, I have allowed you to live like animals. Do whatever you want to with whoever you want. There will be no questioning for you. In group 2 today, although many do not know it, in the lands of Iran, this is also said. There are certain days in the year where it is said that the angels celebrate so much today on the death of so and so Sahabi, that whatever you want to do, do. Because the angels have been told, don't record anything. Group 2. He said, there is no wudu, there is no prayer, there is no zakah. Your religion has been turned upside down. Adultery, fornication, alcohol, everything allowed. This was Qayrawan. From Qayrawan it would carry on and it would enter into the lands of Egypt. This group was so strong because they had the full support of the shayateen. Why were I mentioning this? To understand, 300 years after Islam, there were certain lands which had no Islam. When they entered Egypt, which one point many of us perhaps do not mention, understand or remember or know, the first university that they established for the spreading of the Shia faith was what we today call Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar was not put up by any Sunni. It was put up by this group. And the purpose of Al-Azhar was that the religion of Qayrawan, North Africa, will now spread in the entire world. During that era, the scholars that came out from Al-Azhar were so strong. That the alim, Hafiz Zahabi, wrote, during this time, the Rawafid, meaning the Shia, rose to power in Egypt, Syria, Hijaz means Makkah, Medina, Morocco. Iraq was the capital of the Muslim world. He says in Iraq, they were so strong in power that whoever was going to be selected as the Khalifa, would only be selected after they gave the go-ahead. So even the selection of the Khalifa was coming through the Shia power. Then he writes, the height of their power was in the year 450, where every masjid in the land of Iraq, forget Egypt, Iraq was at that time the capital of the whole Muslim world. 450 years after Hijri, every masjid in the land of Iraq had the word Hayya ila khayr al amal in it, as though they had made an announcement that from today there is no Islam. The entire world is ours. At that time, Shaitan would have said, work is done. As a faith, there is no Sunni Islam anymore. It is nothing but Shiism. This was the power that the Shia rose to in Group 1. A historian of his type writes, and this is one sentence I want you to remember. He says, one of the main signs of the Batini Shia that has been proven throughout history is that at the beginning they appear very humble. They pretend to be pitiful. They act friendly when they are weak. But when they feel strong, they use the worst kinds of tyranny, force and vengeance. And you will understand this when we come just now to what happened in Group 2. So when that Shia menace had now spread to such an extent, the entire Muslim world could not do anything. They could not worry of an outside force because they were caught within their own. That was the time now Shaitan gave the green light that the lands of Sham now must be brought into our hands. So 450, every adhan in Iraq is Hayya ila khayr al amal, that the announcement that we have done our job. In the year 470 from France, Pope Urban II, he makes an announcement. 470 years had gone from Islam taking over the lands of Sham. No Christian at all had ever said, why can't we fight for Sham? The reason is the Christians were going to Sham. They were going to Al-Aqsa. They were going to Jerusalem. The Khilafat was looking after them on the way. They had given them permission to stay in the lands. There was no tyranny. There was no oppression. But just as we know 9/11 when it started, whatever lie it started, 10 years later, the whole world understood it's a lie. World War I, World War II started, 10 years later, everyone understood it was a lie. When the Crusades took place, whatever was said to make the Crusades happen, and how many Christians died for that Crusades, and how many Crusades had to take place. But in the ending, if you ask the Christian, why did you all come to the land? Then everyone will say, what we were told as soon as we came to Sham doesn't make sense. What they were told, this was the speech that Pope Urban II gave, and then this started the Crusades. His speech, which was going to be then said in every church in Europe. So it's a point this, that remember we mentioned that the Crusades were done because of group another, the third enemy, the hidden enemy. For the hidden enemy to make every church in the world or every church in Europe to say the same sentence, it meant that every pope of every church had to be somehow bought into this group. In today's time, when we speak about puppets in every government, then we say there is no church anymore. Now it is states, it is countries. But for what's happening today to be happening, how at that time every church was bought over, in today's time every cabinet is bought over. At that time how every pope had to say the same sentence, in today's time every president will say the same sentence. If someone wonders how come they all have one voice, at that time they all had one voice. With one voice they all said this. They said the land of Al-Aqsa and the land around Constantinople is crying that a very evil and ugly man has taken over. Whereas the Muslims were there already for 450 years. He said the holy suffalcio of Christ that is crying out, who will come and take me out of the hands of filthy people? Then he wrote, our churches are being burnt by the Muslims, where no churches were being burnt. He said caravans are being attacked. Evil and transgression is spreading in the lands. And then he said, And our own lands are too small. So whoever will go there, you can become lords of any land you want. Why don't you go? And then the church was going to say, whoever will go for the crusades, whatever sin you have done or you will do, just because you're getting on that ship, everything has been forgiven. So who wouldn't go? They said, on the call of every church, 300,000 now got ready. This was the crusades. How fast it happened and what a group came out. We saw it in 911. How fast it happened. How quick the claim came, as though it was ittifaq or spontaneous. But as the call of the church had 100 years planning before it, today's 911 also had 100 years planning before it. Everything was put into place. The Shia was there to make sure the Muslims are not strong. So a non-Muslim wrote this, and this is a point to take. He wrote, after 300,000 people responded, what really made the first crusade so successful was not the size of the army of the Europeans. Rather, it was that the Muslims were very, very occupied with the differences that existed between the Sunni and the Shia. They were surrounded by the Shia from two sides, Egypt and Persia. Because being preoccupied with the war of the Shia, the Muslim army, which easily would have warded off the Europeans, could not stand up at all. Exactly as in group one, in group two today, had there not been the Shia threat, the land of Al-Aqsa would never have been taken away. Without that inner enemy, the Christian European will never dare to go forth. They have to plan them first, 100 years before they even think of moving. So for a non-Muslim to write this, you can understand that everyone who went through history would have seen that the biggest threat to the Muslim was not the outside enemy. It was always the enemy from within. He says in 510 AH, so they entered 471, the call was made of the Crusades. Within 50 years, the entire land of Sham was no longer Sham. He says in the year 510, four major Christian kingdoms of the Holy Land had been established. Antioch, Edessa, Tripoli, and Jerusalem. What this means is, in 50 years, the land of Sham was no longer Sham. Every masjid was now going to be a church. And every place where it was said, La ilaha illallah, was now going to be said, there are three gods, Allah is only one of the three. That 50 years was like the worst for the Muslim Ummah. And at that time, if anyone was asked, that do you think Islam will ever come out of this? That on one side you have the Shia threat which has gone through the Muslim lands. And on the other side you got the Christian European which has taken over the lands. And you expect your Sunni Islam to break at two groups. While this was carrying on, now enters group number three. Quiet, doesn't get involved in any war, hardly comes in the newspaper. His name will never feature. But behind the funding of both groups, behind the creation of two groups, so 1 year after Jerusalem is conquered, 9 people come up to the king of Jerusalem, who is now a European king. They are going to be known as the Knight Templars, or Knights of the Temple. They will be different from every other knight who took part in the Crusades. That every other knight, every other soldier who took part came for wealth. This group never come for wealth. Everyone was worried of taking land. This group would come and they would say, we are pious people. We are chaste people. We look after people. And we do not ask for money, rather we will give money. What we want to do is we want to look after the lands of Al-Aqsa. We will look after the route from Europe all the way to Aqsa. So every Christian who wants to come on the journey, he will not be attacked by any Muslim. We will control the borders and we will make sure as the Christian worships in the holy site, Masjid al-Aqsa, then no Muslim ever interferes. So the Christian king will ask these 9 people, what do you want for so much of service? So they say, not a single cent. We will do it from our own site. And then this 9 people will establish a site. And this is something which for many years was what was called hidden history. In today's time, it's no longer hidden. They themselves have mentioned it, and those people who dug under Al-Aqsa saw it already. This group of 9 people will start an entire organization called the Knight Templars. They will run the borders of the entire land. Everything coming in from Europe and going out will be seen under their eye. All that they want is that this 9 people will put up a hut in the front part of Masjid al-Aqsa. So Masjid al-Aqsa is huge. For many times when we were small, we used to see the green dome. And at that time we thought that where the green dome is, where the dome of the rock is, we would think that is Masjid al-Aqsa. Then a time came where I saw a poster where they said, this is not Masjid al-Aqsa. Masjid al-Aqsa is another old building in the front. So then I went that way. Then when we went to Madrasa, we realized Masjid al-Aqsa is the entire thing. The entire complex is Masjid al-Aqsa. The dome of the rock is part of it. The masjid in front is part of it. It's huge. But for this group, the part that matters is only that front part. That time in group one, they would put up their hut there. They would call it the old stables. Or they would call it the site of the old land. And what they would do, which today is no longer a history, mystery of history, because they themselves said what they did. For the next 12 years, they would dig. That's all, digging. Which would seem so trivial. But if you ask, what did you do for getting the chance to dig? They would say that the entire crusades, we manufactured it. We took over every church in Europe. It could have taken us a period of 100 to 150 years. How much of billions had to be invested to buy, one off. Just for the chance to dig. For the chance to dig, we created the Shia menace. We spread them in the lands. We brought the Muslim and the Christian to fight. Just for the chance to dig. So you ask, what is so valuable that the entire war, where hundreds and thousands had to die, just to get the chance to dig? So that secret will remain their secret. But they understood the value of what they were digging for. And for the next 12 years, they dug. And they really found what they were digging for. After 3 years, the first group was sent back to Europe with the findings. Europe was very happy, whoever had funded the entire mission. And for another 7 years, they were going to dig. The only reason the digging came to an end was after a period of about 12 years, the king of Jerusalem, who's a Christian, news comes to him that these people who are digging, one man also was with them. And he said, I went into the tunnel, I was part of the group, and I found them doing the worst satanic acts. They are not Christian, they are not Jew. They are worshipping idols and other things. They are open Satanists. And when he mentioned that they got the picture of Jesus, and in front of that they are doing these satanic acts. So there was an entire inquiry, and the king had them all killed. So at that time when he was killing, the one man who before dying said, you can kill us, but what we came to this land for, we attained it already. They needed something in that land, which we will not go into now, because it's already history. But so valuable that thing was in the bottom of Al-Aqsa, that the entire war of those lands were for something which was under Masjid al-Aqsa. So this was the story of group one. At that time, Allah Tabaruk Tala then just makes one decision. There is no Islam as Sunni Islam in the world. There is only Shia propaganda everywhere. The lands of Egypt do not have a single hadith. There is no Fathul Bari, there is no Umdatul Qari, there is no Mirqat, there is no Muhaddis in the land of Egypt. It is Shia from the beginning, Shia to the ending. The scholars of Azhar are the best scholars in the world. And as they move, Karbala and 10th of Muharram is a thing that the whole world knows. Matam is carrying on left, right and center. North Africa is theirs. Egypt is theirs. The power is in Iraq. The power is in Sham. At that time Allah Tawarukala creates one man, Yusuf bin Ayyub Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. He comes onto the scene and Allah Tawarukala uses this one man to fight against both forces. The why I wanted to mention him, every one of us knows Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. Because from the time we were small, we heard about him in school, in madrasa. And everyone, when the time comes for Al-Aqsa, we speak about who looked after Masjid Al-Aqsa. Who saved Masjid Al-Aqsa. So the name comes Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. So much we know. What we don't know, and that's the point I want to mention. From the age of 16, for the next 16 years, Salahuddin al-Ayyubi was going to do mission one, which was to fight against the Shia. Only after he completed mission one, was he going to go on to mission two, which was to fight against the Christians. For some reason, this mission one, where this one man completed a miracle of Islam, he entered into the scene where the Mahdi had announced every halal is haram is halal. Where every masjid in the khutbah used to make the mention of Al-Mahdi in the khutbah. When the Shia Khalif was regarded as the Khalif, not the Khalif of Iraq. Where every adhan is Hayya ila khair al-amal. This Salahuddin al-Ayyubi at the age of 16. His master, who is Nuruddin Zengi, understanding that we'll never defeat the Christians as long as the Shia is not dealt with. But can you fight with the Shia? Impossible. They were strong in and out. They had an empire. So Nuruddin Zengi will send Salahuddin al-Ayyubi to work under the Shia. He will make a deal with the Shia Khalif that it seems you need extra protection for your empire. It was called the Fatimi Empire. Azhar was theirs. The world was theirs. There was a time Makkah and Medina was theirs. He says, it seems you will need extra protection for your empire. Will you be allowing me to send some of my men? At the age of 16, Salahuddin al-Ayyubi puts his first step into the lands of Egypt. He will enter into a land where there is no Islam. Where every Jummah, every masjid, every alim is nothing but in and out Shia. What a miracle it must have been for this boy at the prime of his youth that when he ends 16 years later, now how to go through that whole story is unique. But if you just understand the ending, there is an article which, or some lines which someone wrote. He said, from 559 AH, from the age of 17, for the next 16 years, this Mujahid fulfilled the mammoth task of entering into the capital state of the Shia, winning over the masses. That's hard. You enter a town which no one likes you. In our small South Africa, you can understand. I come from a different madrasa. Just because my madrasa is different, they'll say, watch out. I come from a different madhab. Just because my madhab is different, they'll say, watch out. I come from a different country. This was a man who was coming from the Sunni into the land of the Shia. For him to win over the masses itself was called a karamat, a miracle. Winning over the masses, gathering control over the army, and slowly but surely eradicating every Shia symbol and practice that was previously regarded as state law. It was Salahuddin al-Ayyubi that would change the University of Al-Azhar from a Shia force into a madrasa of the Ahl Sunnah. It was because of him that the words Hayya ila khair al-amal was removed from the adhan of Egypt, bringing it back onto the Sunnah method after a period of about 280 years. It was through his efforts that the name of the Shia Khalifa, as well as the originator of their faith, Ubaidullah, was going to finally be removed from the khutbah and replaced with the virtues of Abu Bakr, Umar, Usman and Ali and the family members of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. How difficult a task this was can only be understood by one who attempts removing customs from people. The land of Egypt for 200 years had heard nothing but Shia propaganda, loves of stories of the Ahl Bayt, 10th of Muharram Matam processions, etc. So as he took it, changing, how many things he changed. He reaches the peak now of his success, where Nuruddin Zangi, his master, writes a letter to him, that now you have come to such a state in Egypt, that it seems that the only thing that is left is in the khutbah. Now remember, the khutbah is the khutbah of Jummah. In the khutbah, the name of Mahdi and the name of Al-Adid, who was the present Khalif, must not be mentioned. You might think it's a very small thing, but for the land of Egypt, that one sentence not coming in the khutbah was war. This was the one point where Salahuddin Al-Ayyubi wrote back to his master. And he says, I fear if that name is not mentioned, the entire Egypt will stand up again in arms. And whatever I have attained in the 16 years in one sentence will be washed away. Just leave the name, that's all. I have taken out the signs. I have taken out the abuses and the curses. I have taken out the hayya ila khayril amal. I have done everything. One last thing, just leave it. But look at this man, Nuruddin Zangi. He writes a letter that this religion of Islam is a religion that will always make itself pure again. It will never allow dirt to remain. He says, so it's either you going to be used to make it clean or somebody else. If you're too scared to do it, the next man will come, he'll do it. He says, don't lose the opportunity of so much of reward, just do it. A great qadi of his time is sent to now plan this whole thing. When he's planning, all those signs were removed. He would plan and think like, next week we will do this, next week we will do this. Slowly, slowly the judges were removed who were Shia. So the judges couldn't make a sound. Statesmen who were Shia were removed. Military might was removed. Slowly, slowly. Because when it's going to be done, this one act, that there is no name of Mahdi, you have to make sure the entire Egypt doesn't go wild. Finally, the time comes where it hits the month of Muharram. And Muharram is the world of the Shia. From the 1st till the 10th of Muharram, that's their month. That month it had to fall, that the command was given, now is the time, take out. Which would have been, like you say, the most inappropriate time. But Islam was going to show, when I want to become pure, I will do it in any manner. So the first week in the khutbah, the name is still kept, but the qadi just made an extra addition that he said in Arabic, so no one would understand, that O Allah, guide the followers of Mahdi and Adid. So Mahdi and Adid's name was still going to be mentioned, only Allahumma Mahdi. That O Allah, guide them. So those who understood wondered where this came from. And those that never understood, but the name was there. And the following week, Azhar for some reason could not hold the Jummah, because they knew if it had to happen there, there would have been a war. So that masjid was closed for some preparation, for some restoration, for some need. And in the masjid and every masjid in the lands of Egypt, that name was not mentioned. And it was like the dropping of a bomb. And with so much of worry, Salahuddin Al-Ayyubi must have gone through that week. 16 years of effort. But when it dropped, then it was just like silent. And it's mentioned the following week or within the next week, this Al-Adid passed away also. So Salahuddin Al-Ayyubi sitting with his qadi, he says, had I known he was going to pass away, I would have left it for one more week. He died now. So much of stress. So the qadi laughed and he said, that O Sultan, had you not taken out his name, you wouldn't have died. He died because of that. That was the death of Shiism in the world. But to understand the gift of Salahuddin Al-Ayyubi, ask any student of hadith what you understand of hadith. He will say, names that are in my mind is Fathul Bari, Umdatul Qari, Mulla Ali Qari's Mirqat, Egypt became a land of the ahadith of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam. When Salahuddin al-Ayyubi entered Egypt, forget shuruhat of ahadith, there was not the mention of a single hadith. Because every sahabi is a kafir. So there was no ahadith at all in the land. The thanks that goes to bringing Egypt and benefiting the whole Muslim world. So it's written, had this favor of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi not been upon the ummah, Egypt would not have become the center of ilm of ahadith, producing the likes of Hafiz ibn Hajar, Badruddin Aini, Mulla Ali Qari and others. Yet for some strange reason, this gigantic favor of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi hardly ever gets mentioned. I never heard it. You never heard it. As though some shaitani element had the fear that if Muslims were to realize how Salahuddin al-Ayyubi viewed the Shia threat and how he worked tirelessly to rid the ummah of its poison, they would also start despising the Shia and they themselves would strive to rid the ummah of this poison. Because everyone loves Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. But it's never mentioned what he did. 16 years of his life. Generally, when one speaks of this great giant of Islam, it is only his rescuing of Al-Aqsa from the hands of the crusaders that is discussed. Whereas the efforts of this great man in rescuing Islam from a kufr ideology that was spreading like wildfire amongst innocent Muslims was indeed just as important, if not greater. The grasp of the crusaders over Al-Aqsa was indeed one of the most trying times for the ummah, but it never became a cause of irtidad. Muslims never became murtad. The crusaders never made someone lose their iman. Rather, in the efforts to save the masjid, many believers were blessed with martyrdom. Whereas in the case of the grasp of the Shia over much of the Muslim world, thousands were being robbed of their iman and were being made into eternal fuel for the fire of Jahannam. So that effort of 16 years would be regarded as even more important for Islam than this. But it's not mentioned. So it's something to think about. 16 years of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi was to worry about that inner threat. Thereafter, the next 15 years would be concentrated on getting the Muslim armies. And that is the story of Al-Aqsa, which is a very unique itself. And how he mobilized the armies and how he brought them. And the brink of his success was what we call the Battle of Hittin. And after the Battle of Hittin, it was like the doors of Al-Aqsa opened. So the Battle of Hittin, after it happened, there was one nice letter that really appealed to my mind and heart to understand what was the condition of Islam in that 300 years. That everyone had lost hope. The Shias were throughout and the Crusaders were out. So when the Battle of Hittin was finished, which was the battle against the hugest Crusader army that was ever formed in the Crusades. So when he defeated them, his Qadi, who had been with him in Egypt, he was known as Qadi al-Fadil. Salahuddin al-Ayyubi himself will say that the world will say, I am the conqueror of Egypt. And I brought Islam in Egypt. And I am the conqueror of Al-Aqsa. He says, but it wasn't me, it was Qadi al-Fadil, my ustad. He says, because whatever I did, he told me how to do it. This was a brilliant scholar of his time. But it just happened in the Battle of Hittin, he was not there. So he wrote a letter after that. In the beginning of his letter, he said that there was a time when I was your master. You have now become my master. He said, you are the master of the world. Allah has given you dunya also, you are the king of the world, but he has made you the king of the year after. So after praising him, then he wrote the sentence. He said, your servant is writing this letter when heads have not yet been raised from sajda and tears have not yet been wiped from cheeks, meaning every wali of the time on the destruction of the Christians at Hittin was in sajda. Because this was the coming back of Islam to the lands of Sham. He says, so I'm writing the letter while the other awliya are still in sajda. Their tears are still on their cheeks, but I am now writing. Every time your servant thinks of the churches which shall now be turned back into masajid, and that in the places in which it was said that Allah is the third of three, again we will now hear La ilaha illallah, that Allah is the only one. Why it appealed to me, the sentence, is because every wali of the time understood that the land of Sham in that period of 100 years was not a Muslim land. There was no masjid which was going to be calling the adhan. It was a church. It was a system, center of Europe. And for the awliya of the time to see now Islam coming again. So he says, every time the servant thinks about so many masajid which will again become masajid, he renews his thanks to Allah, sometimes verbally, and sometimes from the flow of tears from his eyes. So this was the entire group. Group one, three enemies. There was the Christian world, which everyone knew, and everyone hated, and everyone said, how could you take Al-Aqsa? But the Christians were the in-between. They could never have done what they got without the Shia that came 100 years before them and laid the ground. And they only did what they wanted to do because they were being spurred by another group which was called the hidden force. That three enemies came in, they took over the entire scene, the digging of Al-Aqsa took place, Islam gave them the chance, one command of Almighty Allah came, one man rose up, one slap was given, the Knight Templars disappeared from history, the European Christians were not going to be seen in the lands of Sham, and the Shia threat, the Fatimi Empire, completely collapsed on the hands of one unique individual of Islam. Islam was going to give an announcement that bring the worst of the worst. I will give them the chance of 100, 150 years. One divine slap will come and everything will go flying. 100 years after Salahuddin Alayyubi would start the what we call the Ottoman Empire, which we spoke about last time that we came, and Islam would just start climbing steps. And when it would reach about 950 years, which we said group one was about 1,000 years, and at 950, 960 years was the era of what is called Suleiman the Great, Suleiman Qanuni, the magnificent Suleiman. At that time, Islam was regarded as the strongest force in the entire world. And it had reached that force that it had never reached from the beginning. So Islam was going to say at the beginning and at the end, it is nothing but Islam. And O Kufr, you will have your chance for a few days within. But the beginning and the end is mine. Group one, we want it. After 1,000 years, one's going to now start group two. That's what we grew in. To understand group two will be much more easier because majority of it we saw. Or we learned in school history. Perhaps we never just joined the puzzle. Group two again had to start with the same. Shaitan would say, first I need the Shia. Then I need the European Christian. And the third, I need the digging under Al-Aqsa again. The digging is a unique part of both groups. So important that digging is that the entire World War I and World War II, which would see the deaths of over 50 million people, if someone has to say what was the purpose of the entire thing, it will say to give the small group the chance to dig. She'll wonder, what is it you're digging for? But again, so starting the Shia threat. Between the 16th and the 18th century, what we call Iran today, Iran was a land which from A to Z was filled with the most brilliant of the scholars of the Sunnah. It was a land where scholars existed of such a level that the Ottoman Empire would send their students to the land of Iran to become scholars because they did not have the level of ilm that they had. From that level, like how Egypt was chosen in group one to be the Shia, Allah Tabaruk Tala had now given it to Iran. So a man like how Ubaidullah just walked in a land which was full Sunnah. A man called Ismail walks in a land which is full Sunnah, Iran. He is going to be called Ismail the First. Within 10 years, whichever land his army takes over. A historian wrote, and this is a non-Muslim writing, so you can understand how terrible this man has been, must have been. A historian wrote, Ismail was the most successful and intolerant Shia ruler since the fall of the Fatimids. It appears that he aimed for the complete destruction of Sunni Islam, and he largely achieved that goal in the lands over which he ruled. His hatred of the Sunni knew no bounds. His persecution of them was ruthless. What the Fatimids did, he was going to do the same. He required the first three caliphs to be ritually cursed. He abolished the Sunni orders. He seized the properties of the people of the Sunnah. He gave the Sunni ulama a choice: either convert to Shiism or die. Shia scholars were brought in from other regions to take their place. Before the 16th century, there was no Shiism. But just like how the Fatimid Empire came out from nowhere, Iran Shiism also came out of nowhere. And it was going to become stronger and stronger and stronger. Many of our people would think that when Khomeini came, he stopped it. But Khomeini was just to make it even bigger and broader than what it was. This was a group exactly like the Fatimid. During the Fatimid rule, the first group one, tolerance would only be shown to non-Muslims. They would kill the people of the Sunnah. He says, similarly in Iran, the people of the Sunnah were the ones that had to suffer. That is why today in Iran, the people of the Sunnah got no religion. They got no masjid. They got no rights. But as for the Jew in Iran, they are living a very comfortable life. Today, it's no secret. With Google and internet, you just have to go Jews in Iran. And you will see articles and articles of people saying, we live in Tehran. We have mass gatherings. We come in the centers. Our churches, our temples got the Star of David. No one troubles us. When Khomeini took over Iran, one of the verdicts that he passed, he says the Jews in Iran are not the same as the Jews of Israel. Therefore, they will be treated as an integral part of the Islamic Republic. He could never say that for the Sunni Muslims of Iran. It was only for the Jew. It was for this reason that when Maulana Manzoor Nu'mani wrote that he heard Khomeini saying, I want unity in the Ummah. But there was no way that he showed that he wanted unity. So he wrote this. He says, when a few years back, Ayatullah Ruhullah Khomeini gave the call for an Islamic revolution and set up the so-called Islamic revolution, it was well expected that in order to make his call popular, he would not reopen the pages of bitter history and continuous disputes and controversies between the Sunni and the Shia, meaning what started after the 16th century and how they hated the caliphs. And the way Khomeini said, I want unity. So if you wanted unity, don't mention those points. Just carry on ruling as a Shia, but don't bring about that stories. In fact, it was expected from such a strong leader that he would have in fact told the people of Iran, as long as we continue saying that the Sahaba were Shia and they were the worst, then how are we going to give dawah to the non-Muslim? Because when the non-Muslim will ask us, what is the proof of your Islam? And they will say that the first group who lived around Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, if they themselves did not believe in him really, what do you expect of people who are coming after so many years? So Khomeini would have supposed to have told that to open up the doors of dawah to the non-Muslims, let's just cover these pages. He says it was hoped that Khomeini, in order to establish the authority of Islam, when it was needed so much, would choose to forget the past Shia beliefs and to begin a new chapter which would show the beautiful picture of Islam so that it could serve as a great dawah to non-Muslims from around the world. Unfortunately, the very opposite occurred. Hundreds of writings, books, pamphlets was soon being spread, in which Khomeini himself expressed the old Shia beliefs. In his book Al-Hukumatul Islamiyah, he had expressed the view that the Shia Imams are divine, that they occupy a rank higher than that of the Anbiya, meaning what Ubaidullah had said, I can make haram halal, we can also make haram and halal, and that the whole world is under their command and authority. This was Khomeini writing. No Muslim in his life would ever think a Muslim could ever write this. Likewise, in his Persian book Kashful Ashrar, he has not only criticized and condemned the Sahaba, particularly Abu Bakr, Umar and Usman radiallahu anh, but has used such language that can only be used for a gang of wicked men, evildoers, conspirators and sinners. These perverted assertions and beliefs go side to side with his call. These are mentioned not in secret instructions or private letters, but are contained in published books and journals. So what the crux of this whole thing is, just as how the Fatimi Empire was needed for the Crusaders to do what they did, similarly the Shia was needed for what was going to happen after that to happen. Once the Shia was done, then Shaitan would give the go-ahead that now the Christian European source must come about. Now there was no church in the world. After 1,000 years, the churches of Europe had died. Now it was called the secular Europe. It was called the state. In the states, different states were coming up. But the strongest of them, which was in the front line of Shaitan, was going to be Great Britain. Great Britain was going to become so strong, that one quarter of the entire world was going to be theirs. They would rise now, because Islam now had said, we'll give you your in-between time. You can make yourself the most strongest and strongest. How at that time European church was so strong, and they took over the entire lands of Sham. Now Great Britain was going to do the same thing. So it was going to lead to a stage. Great Britain would understand that for them to get what they needed, and what they needed, the land of Al-Aqsa. And why Al-Aqsa? So that digging can take place. For them to get that, there was one thing that was necessary, that as long as the Khalifa was still existing, the land of Al-Aqsa would never be taken over. And very fast I will go through this, so at least me and you and your children can understand how history then went and who was used to bring us to the position that we are now today. At that point, the Khilafat, the Ottoman Empire, was now weak because it was round two. And every round you have your up and down. The Ottoman Khilafat was weak. It was called the weak man of Europe. Great Britain was strong. European powers were strong. But still they were not ready to hit the lands of Al-Aqsa. The Ottoman Empire was in debt. At that time, Great Britain now needs that inner support. The Shia is there, but they need even more. So what will happen? My friend wrote a book. So I asked him permission to take part of the book. The book is not yet published. It's regarding the lands of Turkey. But in that he wrote a few paragraphs which really appealed to me, and I will go and read this practically word to word. Just to understand that how this happened. As Christian France had once been used to orchestrate the movement of the Crusades in order for satanic forces to get open access to the lands of Al-Aqsa, now Great Britain was to be employed for that very purpose. First to be done was weakening of the Khilafah. World War I began in 1332 after Hijri. So unique it was, just like how there it started 300 years after Hijri, when the Shia started. Here in the next one, it was going to be again from 1,000, we come to 13, 300 years down the line. But group 2, as we mentioned, it's most likely 500 years. So 300 years down the line, World War I. Prior to this, the Usmani Khalifa still existed, but it was an extremely weak and fragile Khilafat. It was referred to as the sick man of Europe. Ottoman sultans were trying to revive it, but it was too hard against the strength of Europe. Sultan Abdul Hamid was a very pious man. He was dealing wisely with the Russian, the French, the British and the Austrians. He understood everyone wanted to jump. He had built the Hijaz Railway. He had established an Islamic university in China. And he was totally opposing the Zionist idea of land in Israel. And loudly he was telling the people of Turkey that there is a group in the land Turkey called the Young Turks. I don't trust them. They haven't learned in our lands. They have been brought up in Britain. You cannot allow them into the politics. But because these Young Turks were so strong, so the Young Turks, they made a deal with Germany, which was known as the secret deal, that if Germany has to ever go to war, then we will join you in war. And when World War I took place, which had nothing to do with the Muslim Ummah, but because of the secret deal of this group called the Young Turks, of whom Mustafa Kemal was then going to be the leader, the entire Muslim world was pulled into a war which it knew nothing about. So World War I started. But before the war could start, because they understood even with the war, the Ottoman Empire somehow will fight the whole world. So what they had to do, the British used a multi-pronged approach to destroy the Khalifa. First they went to the Arabs and they explained to them the issue of Arab nationalism. That you, an Arab, a Turk, cannot rule over you. You must rule over yourself. For this year, universities were opened up in the lands of Syria, Jordan, Lebanon and Palestine. Nationalism was taught in their schools. And two people in the lands of Hijaz were brought. One was going to be called Sharif Hussein, what we normally know then became the kings of Jordan and other lands. Saddam Hussein, they were all part of that Hussein family. And the other one was Abdul Aziz Saud. And because of him, we understand Saudi Arabia. Sharif Hussein was in charge working under the Ottomans. Abdul Aziz Saud was a leader of a small tribe. He had no part in politics at all. Two people were brought in by the British. Both of them were promised that if you will rebel against the Ottoman, then we will allow you to establish your own Arab rule over the lands of the Arabs. We will give it all to you. That deal was signed, and at the same time Britain is signing another deal with France, that when this war is over, the lands of the Arab, we will divide it between me and you. I will take so much and you will take so much. Abdul Aziz and Sharif Hussein, they can go running to whoever they want to run. But Abdul Aziz and Sharif Hussein now were going to rebel. Because of the rebellion, Maulana Hussein Ahmed Madani rahimullah most likely wrote, or somebody else wrote, that when the war took place, World War I, the Ottoman Empire, despite being so weak, fighting on so many different fronts, was still successful in keeping out the threat. It was only because of the Arab rebellion that in the ending it collapsed. Had that not been there, the Muslim, which was so weak at that time, would have also destroyed the entire Europe. But when this war took place, having fallen for the trick of the British, the Sharif attacked the Turks, taking over lands which were under the Usmani Khilafah, such as Makkah, Jeddah, Amman, Damascus. The Usmani Khilafah was forced into World War I on the side of Germany because of the Young Turks, who entered into a secret agreement with the Germans. The Sultan was left with no choice but to declare jihad against the Allied forces. The Khilafah was stretched due to fighting on many fronts, the Caucasus, the Dardanelles, Palestine, Iraq, Izmir, Antalya, Romania, Hijaz. This allowed the British and its allies to invade Muslim lands. Iraq was lost in 1333, Baghdad and Palestine in 1335, Damascus and Istanbul in 1336. In this way, every capital of Islam was taken by the Allied forces. This is exactly like Group 1 when we said, when they entered Sham, in that period of 50 years, they took over the entire lands of Sham. To see them taking over at that time brought the same tears like the first time. The only thing is, this time they never established churches because they understood it won't work. The first time they put up churches in the lands of Sham, When they saw it never worked, the second time what they were going to do, they were going to leave the masjid as masjids. But the only thing is the imams of the masjid and the leader of the country was going to be their people. So we will leave you thinking you are a Muslim as long as your leaders will do what we want them to do. So every masjid would become a secular masjid. Every madrasa would become a secular school. And every leader will be called a puppet leader. No church was going to come in these lands now. But no land was going to have Islam. In group one, the Christians had to outlaw Islam, which wasn't easy. In group two, it was the Muslim. Mustafa Kemal in Turkey was going to say that I want nothing with Islam at all. So much hatred he had for Islam that the Turkish language, which had a lot of Arabic words in it, even for that they had an entire force created that you will go through the language and any word that originated from Arabic also, we will take it out of the dictionary and bring another word in it. It was called Istanbul, the city of Islam. He couldn't stand the word Islam. It had to be Istanbul. And previously we mentioned, but the same was going to happen. Turkey was then going to be the example for Iraq and for Egypt and for Syria and for Jordan. And the entire land was going to become worse than what it was even in group one. In group one there was churches, but Muslims remained on Islam. In group two, Muslims were going to be made open murtad. To add insult to injury, the colonial powers now ruled over vast stretches of the Muslim world. Most of Northwest Africa was under French rule. Italy ruled over Libya. Britain remained in control over Egypt, Sudan, India and the Malay states. In compliance with the Sykes-Picot agreement, the Middle East was now going to be cut into pieces. With the French taking Lebanon and Syria, the British taking the bulk of Hijaz. When World War I ended in 1918, 4 years, the biggest losers of World War I were the Muslims. The Usmanis lost most of the Khilafah, and the Arabs under Sharif Hussein did not get the lands they were promised by the British. Every capital of Islam ended up in the hands of the Allied forces. After the war, the British and French would cut the Middle East into pieces like slices of a cake. From the original Usmani lands of Sham would be created the nations of Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine. After the war, the Khilafah was going to exist for another 4 years. Then that Khilafah, which was established in Medina in the first year of the Hijri, was now going to be destroyed about 1,300 years down the line. There was first time in Islamic history there was going to be no Khilafah. What we saw, it was never like this year. World War I brought about such upheavals and changes in the Muslim land which were unprecedented in 1,400 years of Islamic existence. The Khilafah was destroyed, Hijaz was snatched away, Palestine was again lost, and the British was now in charge of all Arab politics. No Arabian law will now be made. That time it was Britain and then it was going to switch over to America. The colonial powers had succeeded in carving out nation states. When Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam had taught the Ummah unity, that irrespective of land and race, you are all one. Nation states were going to teach that you will fight for your land, not for somebody else's land. If you are an Arab, you will fight for Arabia. If you are an Egyptian, you will fight for Egypt. Jordanian will fight for Jordan. You don't go and fight somebody else's cause. With the seer now, the land of Al-Aqsa was now there, ready for the grab. So that was the two enemies. And now again we had to come to enemy number three. So quiet, so evil, so deadly. But comes, does his work, and nobody notices. Enemy number three in group one was going to be called the Knight Templars. In group two they would start at what was known as the Bani Brit, a name which perhaps none of us ever heard. Today we call them Zionism, Zionists, or Freemasons, or Jewish Israel, or Ashkenazi Jew. But when they started, it was a group of 10 people again. How 9 people landed up there, nine Templars. 9 people. Here it was going to be a group of 10 people. 10 people were going to come to the land of Al-Aqsa. At a time when the Ottoman was still in power, they were going to establish a lodge in the lands of Al-Aqsa. The lodge was going to be called Jerusalem. At that day, no one knew the word called Jerusalem. Their lodge was going to be called Jerusalem. They would tell people that very soon this land will be our land. 10 years later would be the first meeting in Switzerland, where the announcement would be made that we are thinking of giving a land in Palestine to the Jews. 10 years before this, these 10 people had already established their lodge. This Bnai B'rith group was going to grow up into what was going to be called Zionism for the world, but a quiet group. They would fund, they would give, they wouldn't take money. You Britain, you America, you can go into the land. You can steal the wealth of the land. You can kill the people of the land. You can rule the land. All we want is to be able to dig. That's all. Everything else you do. Israel at the moment, you will not find the Jews of America coming to live in Israel. They will send Jews from around the world. You go live there. We are living happily. All they want in the land of Al-Aqsa is the chance to dig. And we will dig. From the time that Israel was formed, 1948, digging is taking place. So important the digging is that the entire wars that we know, for one digging, to understand what is that possession that they are now looking for. So writing about this group, it's mentioned, just as the appearance of the Knight Templars in Jerusalem had begun with 9, 800 years later, in the spring of 1888, 10 people would establish the first lodge in Palestine, Lodge 379, named simply as Jerusalem. 10 years later, Theodor Herzl will convene the first Zionist Congress, in which he will say that we have decided to get a land for the Jews. A people with no land will go to a land with no people. But the land was already chosen. The digging was needed. But to get this, they needed the Khalifa. So a group of people will now approach Sultan Abdul Hamid in 1901. He will offer the Sultan any amount of money he wanted if he would give Palestine to the Jews. He even offered to settle all the Ottoman Empire debts. But the Sultan refused to be bribed. The Sultan said, "I would prefer my body to be cut into smaller pieces, but I will never give Palestine away." The Sultan also said to him, "I will not sell one hand span of Palestine, because this land does not belong to me. It belongs to my people, and my people gain these lands by spilling their blood. A piece of land that is obtained by the blood of martyrs can never be sold for money. Know that I will never allow this treacherous surgical procedure that you plan to perform on this living body of Aqsa." They understood that the only way to get it was to destroy the Khilafah, and the Khilafah was destroyed. The weakening and the collapse of the Khilafah paved the way for the creation of the Strait of Israel. In 1917, Britain issued the Balfour Declaration that we all done in school. He writes one point, he says, "In retrospect, we see that both Sharif Hussein and Abdul Aziz Ibn Saud's roles in support of the Britain resulted in the formation of Israel." This is a thing which Saudi Arabia perhaps doesn't want to be said, but it is something that cannot be denied. Had there been no Saudi Arabia, there would never have been an Israel. Without Saudi Arabia, there could never have been the creation of this. As a result, the Arab revolt against the Khilafah resulted in the loss of Masjid al-Aqsa for the first time after the Crusades. Palestine became British mandate territory until 1948, when Israel was formed. So Group 2 had done their job. Now Group 3. Just as the Templar Knights wanted nothing from Al-Aqsa but the unhindered chance to dig, so too has it been with the Zionist regime of Palestine. From 1948 until today, something so important lies under Masjid al-Aqsa. So what it is, this is not something we're really going to go into detail. I will just give you a certain indication. There's a puzzle that these people have to make. Who these people are, as I said, they are such a hidden, satanic, They are the only group that in my understanding meets openly with the shayateen. They are told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. Small the group is be, but they are huge in power. They are evil, they are dirty, they are filthy, but they are very, very powerful. They need to create a puzzle. If this puzzle is formed, then they can reach a state where the entire world can be engulfed into total kufr. It will be called the entire world has become nothing but kufr. Not only kufr and shirk, but has become satanic. And the whole world will fall in front of the shayateen and worship. One unique puzzle. When the crusades took place, majority of the pieces of the puzzle, which is a very long story and people have written about it, how they got it, how they understood it, how they put it into pieces, point by point, point by point. Now there is one piece missing in that puzzle. If that one piece is put in, then that entire puzzle starts getting a unique electrifying power. How we call electricity comes because that one bulb was missing, or that one there was a short somewhere. You just put that on and the whole thing comes to life. One thing is missing. This one thing, whatever it is, we will never really know. One day we can perhaps ask. In my understanding, most likely it is the ring of Sulaiman alayhi salam. So it is like something small. Whether it is that or something else, it is so valuable to them that this entire war and wars and holding on to the land of Al-Aqsa. When we were small, we used to hear that they want to bring the lands of Al-Aqsa, the masjid, down. They want to collapse it so that they can build their temple. That is a lie. If they wanted to collapse Masjid Al-Aqsa, how they collapsed 9/11, that entire building, they would have just put dynamite and the whole thing would have imploded, finished. Rather, this jewel is so important, or whatever it is, that they are not digging to break. They have to dig with so much of precision to ensure that if we hit a weak spot, the thing on top will collapse. If that collapses, the chance to find what we want becomes zero. And unique Almighty Allah made it that had this ring not been there, and it is there. In our understanding, it's there, and they are definite it is there. The only thing is they have a hope they will one day find it. In our understanding, we know they will never find it. For whatever reasons Almighty Allah has kept. But when I thought about it, I said, how unique. Had that ring not been there, long ago they would have flown one plane from above and a few dynamite from under, and they would have blown Masjid Al-Aqsa to everything. They would have long ago established a church or a synagogue, or they want what is called a temple, whatever it is. Masjid Al-Aqsa will remain standing. And they will make sure it remains. Because if any part of Al-Aqsa collapses, that tunnel which lies under it, they can't get. Why this is being mentioned? In this recent past few months, when they captured Al-Aqsa again, and they entered into Al-Aqsa, and only for a few days, then again the mystery came, what you all wanted in Al-Aqsa? So the only thing they wanted was papers. You say, papers? What is so important of the papers? What they needed was the drawings of the building. Because after so many years of digging in one area and digging in another area, now they had to go in another area. But before proceeding in the area, you have to understand how it's built. It is structure on a structure on a structure. If you don't know exactly where to dig, there's the fear of everything. That's all they wanted. To get that, they pushed everyone out. They made sure no one knows what we are doing. They stole nothing from Al-Aqsa but papers. Why? Because something lies under. So how unique group one was, three enemies was the Shia, they had to come before. They could open up the way for the Christian European, and they would open up the way for unique digging. It lasted for 1,000 years, Islam at the beginning, Islam at the ending, one slap came, and within 70 years everything disappeared. Group 2, in our understanding, is not going to be more than 500 years. In group 2, again, it started with the Shia. Then it went to the European Christian. And then you had our diggers. All three have come again. The lands of Al-Aqsa made the same claim. That will Islam ever manage to create one individual who can stand up and in a period of 30, 40 years give one slap to the world and everything is gone? So we have seen in the ahadith 100% that it will happen again. So we will bring it to an end on that. Just a few of the ahadith I saw recently which really interested me, I will just go through a few of this to understand where we are now in that part of history which is just waiting for that one final slap. These were a few ahadith that really appealed to the mind because of the manner that it was mentioned. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam mentioned that when you will come to the final now, the end of time, for the hour, qiyamah, what is the last signs? So among the last signs he said, وَالَّذِي نَفْسُ مُحَمَّدٍ بِيَدِهِ, by the qasam of Allah. And normally you will say by the qasam of Allah when you're going to mention something that's unique, that you won't believe it. So in their time it's like unbelievable, can this ever happen? He said, by the qasam of Allah, qiyamah will not be established حَتَّى تُكَلِّمَ السِّبَاحِ, that the first you will have to find is wild animals of the jungle. They will be talking the talk of man. It will not be one lion in one jungle, one lion in another jungle. It will be all the lions, all the tigers, all the bears, all the cheetahs. So I used to always wonder of this, that where will this ever happen? That wild animals will be talking left, right and center. And then when I thought about it, I found it. It started happening the day Disney was created. Disney was created at that time, it was a cartoon lion and a cartoon bear. And it would rise from that level until today we have reached every house sees the lion talking the talk of man. It sees the bear talking the talk of man, the cheetah and the jackal. If ever your eye falls, and try never to watch television, but if ever your eye falls on the Jungle Book or the Lion King or some of those funny characters and you hear that lion saying something which is not its roar, then think of this hadith. That the hour will not be established until you will see the animals of the jungle talking the talk of man. It is no longer a cartoon lion, it's a real lion. A real lion talks and the talk of man comes out. The cartoon has become a real movie. وَيُكَلِّمَ الرَّجُلُ أَذَبَتَ صَوْتِهِ, and when the top of the stick of a man will be talking to the man. In the past, the stick was a huge stick. It would rise from here and it would be used for the man to walk. It would have been understood perhaps at that time that your walking stick will talk. And how it will talk as you are walking and you put your stick, then your stick perhaps will say, hey, don't press me too hard. But it wasn't going to happen like that. It was just going to come that the world was going to invent something called, and this is a point. Look at the word of the hadith, the stick of man. The world was going to invent a USB. They had to call it stick also. They could have called it anything else, but it had to be called a stick. And in the stick, it was going to be the tip of the stick. When that stick would be plugged into the computer, qiraat would come on. A bayan would come on. A lecture would come on. You would put it in your gadget. It would start talking to man. Everything was the stick. When the stick will talk to man, وَشِرَاكُ نَعْلِهِ, and when the shoelace will start speaking to man. In the past, the shoelace of the Arabs was a thin string. And I used to always wonder when that time will come where a thin string will start talking to man. Until I saw it on every person's ear. From his gadget, that wire that goes up. In that era, there was nothing called wires. One white thin string. And it relays the message from ear to your ear. In that thin string is your entire bayan, it's your entire lecture, it's your entire news. That one thin string, one shoelace and one stick. When you will see the shoelace and the stick talking to man, then you understand you are reaching the finals. وَيُخْبِرُهُ فَخِذُهُ بِمَا أَحْدَثَ أَهْلُهُ بَعْدَ, and when the tie of man will start telling man, that you know what, after you left your house, what your wife needed, what she wants, what happened in the house. In the past we understood it. In the time of the Arabs, the pockets were here. There were never pockets here. The time had to come that the pocket had to become here. The pocket could have been here, the pocket could have been here, the pocket could have been here. But the pocket had to become in line with the tie. Because the hadith had explained you would need the tie to be talking. The gadget would go then into the tie. That gadget would go buzz. One time I would think that it needed for the phone to be taken out and put by the ear. So it's still by the ear that you are talking. but that time was going to go also. Now that gadget will make its buzz here, it's already on the tie. And I can see in the next 20 years, there will be no need to even take out the phone. Once that buzz will come, your glasses will be able to show you the message that your wife needs tomatoes and potatoes. One message from the tie will inform man of what's happening at home. La taqumu sa'a, the hour won't come before that. But when that happens, then start preparing for the hour. Sayati ala nasi sanawatun khadda'at. Upon people will come a few years which will be open deception and lies. What we call the era of modern news. Fox Network, CNN, BBC, where one lie will be the lie of the world. We saw it only in 9-1-1, but it started with World War. Before World War, the entire world was not one network. There was not one voice. There was not one call. There was not one school and medium of thought. When it started, يُصَدَّقُ فِيهَا الْكَاذِبُ وَيُكَذَّبُ فِيهَا الصَّادِقُ. When those years will come, you will see a man who will stand up. The wording of the hadith means the liar will be believed and the truthful man won't be believed. But that has always happened. In the era of Nubuwa also, a person who is a liar, if no one knows he's lying, he's believed. For it to become a sign of Qiyamah, what it meant, Al-Kadhib means the one who everyone knows is lying. And everyone will sit and say he's the biggest liar. But when he will say he's lying, everyone will say okay and they'll carry on. The liar knowing he's lying, we saw it when 9-1-1 took place. And when America, which was the greatest detective force of the world, could announce that we have found out who took that building down. Because that aeroplane that hit it, that man's passport came out. The whole world understood a passport cannot survive. But everyone shook their head. Not only they shook their head, the presidents of the world went to war for it. No person could stand up and say, you liar, you are lying. Oh, they said, you liar, we believe you. And As-Sadiq, who the whole world knew, he's speaking the truth. That I am in a cave of Afghanistan. In the cave there is no connection. I cannot be conducting a worldwide war because you are in charge of the internet. I cannot go through any one Gmail. Our poor president, what one point he never understood when he went to the war against the Zionist regime, is you can't use their tools to fight them. So when with his own party, whichever Indian party, he had to send private messages, he never understood nothing is private from the people who made the gadget. So in today's time, when it comes out, the leaked emails, he must be thinking, who leaked them? You tell them the very people who controls them. Because when you lose your password, what you press? You say, I forgot my password. So someone then says, okay, tell us who you are, we'll give you your password. Who's that someone? That very person is the one who reads your emails. But the liar. At that time when he said, I'm in a cave, how can I be running an international world of Al-Qaeda? But the whole world said, no, you are. It made no sense. But the true man who everyone knew was true was said, you are a liar. وَيُؤْتَمَنُ فِيهَا الْخَائِنُ وَيُخَوَّنُ فِيهَا الْأَمِينُ. When someone who's trustworthy, the Maulana of the masjid is supposed to be the most trustworthy. But I'll ask anyone, will you take your money and say, Maulana, look after it for me? Never. And if I ask anyone, the wording of the hadith is, the one that the world all say is the biggest rogue, everyone will trust him. So we all say, who is the biggest rogue? Khiyanat means the most treacherous of all treachery. So everyone will say, it's the Jew. And you'll ask, where's your money? You say, it's in the bank. At the time when Al-Kha'in, the one where the world will say, you are the biggest cheater, biggest deceiver. You press one button tomorrow, my entire account is zero. But when the world will put all the amanat by the one they believe to be the biggest cheater, then you must understand now you are coming to the end. Banks were never in the world before this. When the banks came, it was a sign that now wait for Qiyamah. وَيَنْتِقُ فِيهَا الرُّوَيْبِدَ فِي أَمْرِ الْعَامَّ. And when Ruwaybida will be able to discuss or to pass a verdict which will apply to the entire world. So the Sahaba asked, who is Ruwaybida? For one man to talk and his words to have an effect on the entire world, it means that man must be the most intelligent of intelligent. So the Sahaba asked, who is Ruwaybida? Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, Ar-rajulu tafihi. Tafi means a man who even a young child will say he's an idiot. When you will see an idiot being the president of the world, and young children laughing at his intelligence and IQ, and when you will see his verdicts is affecting the masses, then you must understand we are on that now. Abdullah bin Mas'ud radiallahu anhu, and we will end on this last three. He was asked, what is that last signs? So he says, أَيَّكُونَ الْوَلَدُ غَيْزًا. When you will find a time where the children will have a temper flare, that the parents will say, I'm scared of my child, that he just blows, he goes wild. At that time, غَيْظًا, when the child will go wild, وَأَيَّكُونَ الْمَطَرُ قَيْظًا, and when it won't be raining water from the sky, but it will be raining like acid. That acid has only been seen in what we call today the nuclear wars. When that nuclear bomb hits, that entire sky is no longer normal rain. It is giving out that different chemical that is falling onto everyone. When you will see things coming from the sky which is nothing but, the word qaydan was like a pussy material, a different matter, not water. And then he said, وَأَن تُوَاصِلَ الْأَتْبَاقِ, and this was the one I wanted to end on because that word was too unique. Just like how the stick, when he said تُوَاصِلَ الْأَتْبَاقِ, طَبَقٌ أَتْبَاقِ means a dish. وَاصِلَ يُوَاصِلُ means to join, to communicate. You will see when you go to Saudi Arabia, you will see one of the best internet like groups are, we have Vodacom, and so they will have like مُوَاصَلَات, Muasalat of this one, Muasalat of that one. Muasalat means internet or connection, worldwide connection. Atbaq means a dish. When you will see a dish creating communication around the world, now imagine in the era of the Arabs to think of a dish of food, creating a connection that man is talking with this man because of one dish. You wonder how will one dish. But the world would have to take it out, called the satellite, and they would even put the word dish. It could not be anything else. When you will see a dish creating communication in the world, and look at the next part, وَتُقَاطَعُ الْأَرْحَامِ, and you will find family ties, which the dish supposed to be joining, because the dish will be joining the world, and family ties will be broken. Meaning when you will see on the day of Eid, you said the family must come, but the family don't have to go anymore. Perhaps it's one message I will send you, salam, how are you, meeting, goodbye. With the dish I will communicate with you, but physically I can't meet you now, I'm busy. With the dish I will speak to you from Makkah and tell you how's things by the haram, but if I'm in the town I haven't got 5 minutes to make salam to you also. When you will see family ties broken and the dishes are communicating, then wait for this hour. وَأَن يَكْتَفِي الرِّجَالُ بِالرِّجَالِ وَالنِّسَاءُ بِالنِّسَاءِ, and when you will see men and men and women and women, which will be the order of the day. And when you will see musical instruments and وَلَدُ الزِّنَا, when you will see the desert suddenly becoming the most civilized land, and that's what we saw, where the Dubai, when you went to it 100 years ago, was an empty land. Suddenly it's civilization. And when you will see civilization brought down completely, meaning one war took place and the entire Sham is no longer Sham, entire Iraq is no longer. When you will see a barren desert coming up so fast, and you will see a huge land full of buildings going down so fast, then you must understand that now you are on that last brink. We are in that end. Whether it is like Imam Suyuti says, that this ummah's age will be over 1.4 and not more than 1.5, or whether it will go over that perhaps, my message to you and to myself is that we have reached a brink which every hadith has somehow come out so clear, that has told man that now forget your huge hopes, that I will invest now in this year so my great-great-grandfather's grandson can get this, and this one can get that. Perhaps that will not happen. As that first round came so quickly to an end, Salahuddin al-Ayyubi stood up and one shot it finished, and 1,000 years ended, and Islam said, I am the open victor. Round two, it's also reaching its end. Whether it's another 100 years, another 150, we do not see it being anything more than that. Which means me, or it means my children. Most likely, in the view of Imam Suyuti rahimullah, he had like conviction that this ummah will be more than 1-4, but it will not go more than 1-5. We also do not see it going. Group two has already come. Every Shia group has come. The European threat has come. The digging has been carrying on. All three has done. Now it is one divine command. One unique man will stand up on the name of Muhammad al-Mahdi. And he will make one slap on the ummah. And the entire ummah will unite like how they united under Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. There will be a couple of huge battles like how there was the battle of Hittin. And suddenly the Muslims, Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, when you will see the armies coming with back flags, and they will be making their journey from Khurasan, what we call Afghanistan, all the way into Masjid al-Aqsa, then you must know that the hour is up. We have reached the brink of that, where Afghanistan's army is ready, where the people of Sham are being created, the warriors of Iraq are being created, everything is being happening. So me and you, whether we're young or we're old, we also make that little effort now. Little but haram that we got in our life, may Allah give us tawfiq, now take it out. That interest that we never wanted to leave, my great-great-grandchildren can benefit. They are not going to benefit from it. Don't spoil your akhirah because of it. We have a few years left. Start investing for the akhirah. Make waqf of your lands. Bring your children into deen. Explain to them that Islam got a unique history. And as it slapped kufr once upon a time, all three groups disappeared. It will slap the Zionist regime. It will slap the regime of America and Great Britain. And it will slap the regime of the Shia. And they are at the moment already getting the first few slaps. Things are happening very fast. When you saw the dish coming out, when you saw the stick coming out, when you saw big lands going down to the ground and empty lands coming up, the hadith has told you, when you will see wild animals talking, get ready for the hour. We are in that last. May Allah tabarakallah bring it that revival comes in me and you also. It is a matter of time now and things will just change. Before that time, let us also change our lives. وآخر دعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه وبارك وسلم اللهم لك الحمد كله ولك الشكر كله اللهم لا نحصي ثناء عليك أنت كما أثنيت على نفسك رضينا بالله ربا وبالإسلام دينا وبمحمد صلى الله عليه وسلم نبيا ورسولا ومسرحيم كريم forgiving الله Oh Allah, when you allowed us to be in such a vital time, Oh Allah, yet you kept us with the deen of Islam. Oh Allah, when the ummah went through a stage where irtidad became open and widespread, Oh Allah, in your fadl and your karam, you kept us on Islam. Oh Allah, you introduced us to ulama. Oh Allah, you kept us to the masajid. Oh Allah, in an era of drugs, in an era of porn, in an era of homosexuality and lesbianism, Oh Allah, in such an era of filth and dirt, Oh Allah, you still allowed our hearts to be attached to your masajid. You allowed our hearts to be attached to your Quran. You allowed our hearts to be attached to your ulama. Oh Allah, as you have kept us, Oh Allah, never let us fall from this. Oh Allah, as you have kept us in Islam until now, Oh Allah, let us now not fall out of Islam. Oh Allah, as you have kept us so far, and we are seeing the end of the journey, Oh Allah, let it not be just before the journey gets completed that our ship sinks. Oh Allah, allow us to become part Oh Allah, our children to become part of the army of Hazrat al-Mahdi. Oh Allah, if we cannot give salams to Hazrat Isa alayhi salam, Oh Allah, then let our children be the ones who convey our salams to Nabi Isa alayhi salam. Oh Allah, if our eyes cannot see the victory of Islam, then allow our children to see the unique victory of Islam. Oh Allah, let our hearts, let our bodies, let our lives, let our families become prepared for the final rise of Islam. Oh Allah, let us be part of the unique jihad, the unique war, the unique revival of the Islamic spirit in the entire world. Oh Allah, accept us and our families, accept us, our children,
accept us and our progenies for your most unique, for your most pure, for your most magnificent deen. O Allah, as the name Salahuddin al-Ayyubi would stand in the world, what and what khidmat you had taken from him. O Allah, we ask that from us weak individuals and from our children and our progeny, you allow that unique work to be taken. O Allah, you make our families the next gardens of Islam. O Allah, you make our children the next roses of Islam. O Allah, you make our children the next mujahids of Islam. O Allah, make them the flag bearers of Islam. O Allah, make us proud parents because of them. And O Allah, let us make Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam proud. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala ali Sayyidina Muhammad wa ashabihi wa barik wa sallim. Allahumma inna nas'aluka min khair ma sa'alaka minhu nabiyyuka Muhammadun sallallahu alaihi wasallam wa na'udhu bika min sharr ma sta'adha minhu nabiyyuka Muhammadun sallallahu alaihi wasallam wa anta al-musta'an wa 'alayka al-balagh wa la hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-'aliyyi al-'azim. Subhana rabbika rabbil 'izzati 'amma yasifun wa salamun 'alal mursalin walhamdulillah.
Just one last point, and I mentioned that 1,500 years, I told you, I'm not sure. There's no conviction, so don't go home now and tell your wife it's getting coming to an end. It was a view of a great scholar, but there's a great chance. So to keep that chance in our mind and say there's a possibility, on that possibility, prepare. The person says, I think the cops are trapping. So if the cops don't trap after that, you don't phone him and sway him. You just say, Jazakallah for the reminder. Same here it is.
Assalamu alaikum.